You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode was produced thanks to our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek. Welcome everyone to another episode of the Mythcreens Podcast. I'm Oren, with me today is...
Chris.
And joining us for a third time is recurring super special guest host.
I thought we settled on returning recurring special guest host Jim, father of dragons, breaker of chains, keeper of the chalkboard.
Yes, well, that is accurate, but now we are in the upside down today, so everything is different. Because today we're talking about Stranger Things. You might have heard of it. It's a little indie show on like this new startup streaming service called Netflix. I think they're really gonna go places, guys.
Some of my more my friends in the know have, you know, told me some stuff about this show, saying it's gonna really, really hit the mainstream. Maybe be a cult classic after a couple years when people really, you know, clue into it properly.
Be released on the finest of VHS tapes. Okay. So Stranger Things, the series. I'm pretty sure most people have heard of it by now. We're gonna be, you know, spoilers ahead. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want to be spoiled, you can go watch it now.
Specifically, if you have not seen Stranger Things 2 as well.
Right, season 2 especially. Yeah, because we're talking about that too. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know about you two, but, like, I do know about Chris in this case, but because I cheated ahead of time. But I think that the first season is one of the best things that has ever been on television or on streaming service. I don't know what to call it nowadays, but, you know, serialized video entertainment.
No, I mean...
That really rolls off the tongue.
I concur. I think it is... You know, one of the best TV shows, period. I would say the first season of Stranger Things, definitely.
I'll chime in with very into it. Do like.
Excellent. Well put. Like, if I was gonna try to rate my top favorite TV shows, or at least as far as like how well crafted they are, I think Stranger Things would either be at like number one or maybe in the top three.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to really think about it hard, but and not to say that it is, the first season is without problems. Most notably, the casting is mostly male and almost entirely white. And like the one black main character, Lucas, also has the least to do of all of the you know, the D&D crowd. So that's not great, and, like, Nancy's romance options are an ass and a creeper. Like, not great options for Nancy either. So, it's like, it's got some flaws, but I am in awe of how good they were at balancing the information that every character knew at exactly the right time to make the characters all, like, relevant.
Yeah, I think that is the thing where it really stands out, is that it has tons of characters. They are all working on the problem. None of them feel vestigial. They all matter. And that is just an incredible thing to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that none of their siloing of the information they had felt artificial or contrived. It really felt like there were reasons they weren't telling each other, either because they thought they wouldn't believe them or they didn't know this other person was working on it. There was never any, like, well, why don't you just call this person? What's your problem? Just talk. They always talked when it was appropriate to, and they never felt like they were avoiding an info dump for the purpose of maintaining tension, which really you don't see often, I think.
And it's especially tough when you have kids that are protagonists, because the question every time there are kids in any work is, like, why aren't the adults solving this problem for them? You know? And so... strategically splitting it up into three different age groups and then having each age group do something that felt appropriate for the age group. You know, with the kids, basically they find, you know, 11, the child that is hunted who has superpowers, and, you know, they have a pretty good reason to hide her from their parents, which keeps them siloed and their own. And then the teenagers go and fight a monster. You know, that feels super appropriate for teenagers, which tend to be risk takers and, you know, are more likely to take action. And then the adults do this sort of mystery investigation plot where they, like, hunt down a conspiracy, you know, which is takes more sort of intellectual skills and more knowledge, you know. And so it just feels really well balanced, and they all tackle the problem from a different direction, and they're all important.
Right, and having the authorities be antagonists really helps, right? Because it's like, well, man, there's like, we think our friend is missing. Let's call the police. It's like, these weird government guys showed up, and they're like, don't worry about your friend. She's in a better place now. And it's like, that doesn't sound like real advice. you know. So, like, that really helped. That explained, like, you know, why we can't, like, you know, drop a tank battalion on the Demogorgon, right? It's because the evil government is evil in this context.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't believe you if you told them Demogorgon anyways.
Yes.
Because it's correctly set in a time period without video capture phones and instantaneous communication all the time.
Right. Yeah. That helps.
That really helps.
Oh man, their use of technology in in the first season is so good. Like the use of radio technology to, like, be able to occasionally tune in on, like, strange messages and, like, weird sounds, and, like, Will being able to affect the electronics from across the dimensional divide and, like, the camera and developing the pictures. I love that. I love the plot point of characters not noticing something when it happens and then going back and looking at their pictures of the thing and noticing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, I love that trope so much. It's so creepy.
Yeah, and I mean, and this just working on the basics, of course, all right. You know, we set a big threat at the very beginning. You know, like, we don't waste time, pretty much. Will disappears almost immediately at the beginning of the season. And then there's just really good pacing and really good establishment of the threat. You know, even if they divided tasks successfully between all the groups, if they didn't keep the pacing tight, it wouldn't have been the same.
Yeah, it never, like, stops and drags. And I think a lot of the credit also goes to less tangible storytelling devices and more into things like music and sound effects and lighting, right? Like, those production values are all super high. And maybe it would have worked without them, but they definitely help, right?
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of time and attention, just even, like, the time and attention that they paid to the title sequence. You know, like, every step of the way, you know, it was carefully crafted. And they were creative. Just the whole, as you went into the Christmas lights, right?
Yeah, oh, that's so great. The Christmas lights are fantastic.
Yeah, the Christmas lights that very slowly spell out something creepy, you know, after Joyce has done this elaborate setup all throughout her home. Just that shows a lot of creativity.
I also just, I like it because it's an example of a really beloved and very, like, meaningful story that I don't think is character driven. Like, it has good characters, but its characters are all pretty straightforward.
Yeah, they're definitely the character arcs are definitely secondary to the external threat, right? It's clear that the threat of the Demogorgon is the through line for the season. It is the central plot. And the characters are there kind of supporting that, and that's just fine. Not everything has to be character driven.
Right.
Jim, do you have any favorite things about season one you want to...
I just really appreciated the sort of, again, with the focus on the title screen, making it very retro, and you really feel transported back to the 80s. Not that I was super conscious of my surroundings in the 80s, but it having a period piece, and it's weird that now the 80s are, like,
30-some-odd years ago. It's kind of a period piece.
Ah, so old.
And being accurate and truthful to what's available, what the culture was sort of like, and all those interactions, paying such close attention to that was probably what really makes Stranger Things so appealing to me. And having the not-quite-modern tech level was... just continues to be impressive, and continuing then to see the Stranger Things 2 and like advancing it incrementally with the and seeing these things come out that are contemporary to them but new, I think is impressive with that detail level.
So I think this is a good segue into talking about, you know, it sounds like one of the main criticisms of season one is been that it's too derivative, right? And and I guess the commentary that I've seen is that they, for instance, it is basically like one big tribute to like 80s movies, from what I hear, and that they took too many of the 80s like movie plots like wholesale and pushed them in the show and didn't, you know, change enough, or that it was just kind of copying things from the 80s. Again, maybe if I was more of an 80s aficionado, I would have really noticed this. You know, or maybe if I wasn't, I mean, I was born in the 80s, right? So maybe if I was older, it would also be more obvious.
Yeah, this is hard for me to comment on because I just don't see it. Like, I can see how you can look at Stranger Things and then look at, say, for example, Alien and Aliens and be like, okay, so in the first movie of Alien, it's one monster and it's like super scary, and then in the second one it's lots of monsters. And like they do that in season one and season two, right?
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of these movies that Stranger Things is compared to, but like I'm just having a hard time finding a problem.
I haven't even like heard these comparisons or complaints that it's too derivative of specific movies. And I've seen a lot of, you know, old 80s horror and monster movies, and it didn't feel like, it felt like there were homages maybe and some similarities, but maybe I'm just too, sort of, everything feels the same to me at this point anyways. It's very hard to get me interested in a story based on like, this is a new story you haven't heard before about something that's really different. It's like, it's all the same. That's not what sells me on it. So I would never say that Stranger Things is like mind blowing and breaking new ground on how to do storytelling. It's like a competent monster horror thing that has good characters and is done really well, and it feels like the 80s and is similar to these things, but it's not a complete ripoff, I would say, like, without seeing the arguments for it being a ripoff.
Yeah. I do think that this is one of those cases where it might be partly what I call, sometimes called critic syndrome, where critics, you know, supposedly a lot of critics are there to, especially movie critics, are there to be a discerning audience member that can then tell other people whether the movie is worth watching. But just by being a critic, they become a different audience. And particularly because critics watch so many movies and pay so much more attention to them, things that feel original to a normal audience member will often feel tired and old to a critic. And so they tend to be care a lot more about originality than a normal audience member would. And so this might be a case of like, well, the people that you hear, that you see online writing about, you know, any kind of film, TV show, you know, they are disproportionately critics and they are slightly different than the average audience member.
Right. I mean, I think the reason why I'm having difficulty seeing this as a problem is, like Jim was talking about, it's like, I have seen these plots before, but I've seen them in lots of different things, right? Like, if you get into it, you can generally draw comparisons between one story and a lot of other stories. And like, you know, unless one story is like deliberately trying to be like that other story, and like, I haven't read It, so maybe It is one, because It is about a bunch of kids and a monster. So that might be one that is, that it, the comparison is more direct. But, like, you know, the comparison with Alien that I've seen a lot, which is, like, that's, like, that's just a pretty common trope, man. It's, like, you fight one monster the first time, and then you fight more monsters the second time.
I think that's Tremors and Tremors. Like, there's more of the little sandworms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the sequels. Mm-hmm. That sounds likely.
Yeah, so that, so like, you know, unless you're talking about something like, you know, when a story is deliberately trying to make itself in the image of a previous one, like the Orville is with Star Trek, like, that invites some comparisons, I think, because the Orville clearly wants to be thought of as a continuation of Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's a little harder for me to see that with, like, Stranger Things, because, like, I can definitely, like, you know, compare Stranger Things to movies that I've seen from the 80s and be like, oh, look, that movie, it has this plot element, and Stranger Things also has that plot element. But, like, I can also find you a bunch of things that are not Stranger Things that have that plot element, right? So it's like, I'm trying to put myself in a headspace where I can see that as an issue, and it's just not coming up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I personally, too, don't really feel like this is a problem. But I think I think original ideas and good ideas are a little overrated. It's the technical implementation that really matters. And so, like, as far as I'm concerned, if they stole a whole bunch of, like, plot lines wholesale, but then they managed to stitch them together super well so that somebody unfamiliar with these movies cannot even tell, then I don't care. You know? Like,
yeah.
Even stitching things together takes a lot of skill. Takes a lot of technical skill. Takes a lot of storytelling skill. And, you know, if they just took things, then they clearly did that well.
Right. I mean, honestly, the only reference in the season that I can think of that I have a problem with is the makeover scene with Eleven, which is clearly a reference to E.T., but is also doesn't fit in the story and is kind of sexist because it's like they've got that whole like, oh, you're hot now and like you're a real girl or, you know, whatever is the implication of that scene. And it's kind of gross with when you take it from being an alien when it was just kind of funny because you were dressing up an alien to look like a human and make it about a human girl and dressing her up to look more like a girl, quote unquote. That becomes gross.
Right.
But people, you know.
Particularly when it's boys that are dressing her up to look more like a girl, like boys that are basically doing gender policing on her, is kind of the implication. But yeah.
Right.
And that sticks out because it does not fit, and it's quite possible, again, they did it to, you know, tribute to the E.T., but it did not fit, and so it's not that it's derivative that's makes it bad. It makes it bad because it did not work.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's my feeling on it.
Yeah.
So I'm actually really curious, because I know I've talked about this with Chris a lot. Jim, I want to know, how do you feel about season two?
Season two? I really like season two.
Okay.
I liked it. I feel like if season two existed without season one, it would be a lot worse. It's sort of like a stands on the shoulders of giants sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You need all the context and the buildup and the understanding of the character relationships from season one to make season two even possible. I don't think it was strictly as good as season one, even with the context of season one. But that's, I think, just really, like, regular when you have a really good first season of a show and it's amazing. It's really hard to live up to that, and there's a lot of pressure on, like, writers and creators and stuff. But overall, I appreciated it. I really liked, the big boss. I liked, how the, Newt being sort of vomited up by, Will at the end of season one. I liked, how it tied in really well to that.
Mm-hmm.
Or Dart.
Yeah.
Yeah, D'Artagnan. I don't know why I call him Newt. Oh, D'Artagnan. And I felt really invested with Dustin like, and D'Artagnan's like subplot, because I was yelling at him the whole time, but it was also adorable, and I sort of like got where he was coming from. Though he did seem his like intelligence was dumbed down for that, because he's like very obviously something from the Upside Down, but he was not willing to entertain that idea like at all. He's just like, oh, it's a new lizard, obviously, and it's like, no.
Yeah,
come on, Dustin.
I think that was the D'Artagnan and Dustin thing was really neat and really cute. I think it would have been more successful if we'd seen a stronger motivation for Dustin for why he really wanted this pet, right? Like, because they I think even during season two they even change it. Like, it doesn't... Later, the explanation is that he did it to impress Max, but that is definitely does not seem to be the explanation when he first keeps it, right? And
yeah,
setting up some sort of character need where he as a character, like, feels like you know, maybe feels isolated from his friends, like doesn't have any companionship, or for some other reason really wants a pet. And then feels like this is the pet that's, like, destiny has bestowed on him, you know? Like, so having that setup, I think, would have really made a big difference to that. It was still cute, but it didn't, again, it could have had a lot more emotional power than it did.
If to Monday night quarterbacking here, I think fixing, like, that problem and also, like, Max not having a lot to do, if Max had found it and like adopted it and kept it secret because she doesn't have any reason to know about the Upside Down and that it's a spooky monster baby.
Yeah,
like I think that would have really like two birds with one stone up in there. That was a missed opportunity. And she could have any reason she wants to keep a lizard. It's like she wants a lizard, it's cool. She's in an abusive household and needs like a friend at all.
I mean, and that gives, and if the other characters know about it, that gives them a reason to sort of hunt it down, and then they end up interacting with her, for instance.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and bring her into the fold without any of this, like, we can't tell her, it's a secret. This is our secret Upside Down stuff. No outsiders. And it's like, well, she already has a monster pet. So she knows. Yeah. Or needs
that
to know.
That probably made it feel actually more similar to season one, where it's like they kind of adopt Eleven and Eleven has special powers. It's like this time they kind of like adopt Max and Max has a special pet, you know?
I mean, I would have liked that. I mean, frankly, so I always knew that season two was not going to be as good as season one. Like, I frankly just didn't think it was possible because season one depended on so many very carefully calibrated factors that I think would have been impossible to repeat. Barring some kind of, like, time jump that was long enough to completely reset the story.
Right, with, but, you know, season one had no constraints because it was a fresh story. They could make up whatever they want to. Trying to pull off the same thing with all the constraints that are left from a season one is just,
Right, I do think that, but even despite that, I ended up being disappointed. I did still enjoy it. It's still a decent season of television. But, like, I was disappointed because they created so many of their own problems that they didn't have to. Like, you know, they were like, and I, again, I don't know if this was actually a response to fan feedback. A lot of people think that a lot of their changes are responses to fan feedback. I also think it's possible that writers just do silly things sometimes. But even if it was a response to fan feedback, they were like, okay, we need to have more diversity in our show. And that's true. You guys do need more diversity in your show. And it's like, how are we going to do that? Well, let's see. We have two new characters named Bob and Owens who are really important to the plot and are like really deep in there. And you, the story does not work without them. All right. Those are going to be white dudes. And now we're going to have a gang of people of color who are off somewhere else for 99% of the show, except for when they steal one episode that has nothing to do with the main plot. And it's like, that was your plan to add more diversity? Why? You have Bob and Owen. They were right there. and it was like that just seems so obvious in retrospect. Similarly, they were like, okay, we want to do something with Barb's storyline. Right. And it was like, frankly, you didn't have to do that. Like, I know people were hashtagging justice for Barb, but I don't think any of them actually wanted a completely siloed off main story about them, like, talking to this creepy conspiracy theory dude to, like, I don't know, get some people in the Department of Energy fired, was the end result of that story.
And, of course, the creepy conspiracy theory dude was also a white guy, right?
Right.
Yeah. He was weird. That made me very uncomfortable when he was like, hey, you kids, you should bang. It's like, you don't do that, creepy middle-aged dude with these teenagers in your house. Like, what the actual hell?
Please
then,
stop.
And then, of course, like, they do. So it's like, oh, he was right. He's the wise old communist.
That makes him even
something.
Creepier. The fact that the writers decided to make him, to not overly make him, like, invasively psychoanalyze and talk down to these people about how they should run their lives, but also decided that he should be totally right about it.
Totally right. Genius. yeah, and that whole plot line, like, the end result, like, their goal was to get Barb's parents to stop wasting money on a private investigator and to give them closure of some sort. Which, like, they do, but also the fact that Barb's parents needed closure was never, like, a leftover thread that needed tying up.
Right.
So I had, like, no idea why they introduced it.
It's like, okay, guys, it's like, if that was a response to fan feedback, then they completely misread fan feedback, okay? Because the fan feedback was, we love Barb, we want Barb back. Now, I don't know if that would have been a good idea either, but that's what they wanted, and for some reason, they heard that as, you want more people to get their comeuppance. It's like, no, last season, the guy who got Barb killed died, or at least you implied that he died. Apparently, maybe Brenner is still alive. But he, as far as we know, he died horribly. I was okay with that. I felt like justice had been served.
I mean, it was clearly came out of people being disappointed that Barb was killed. And I think some really good commentary in first season, the cast was not diverse enough. And Barb was a female character that was clearly not there to be sexy, was clearly not there to be a love interest, and she was killed off. And that was immensely disappointing. And I don't think bringing her back was the right choice, just because, especially when you have a kind of, you know, thriller or horror like this, you don't want to just casually bring characters back from the dead, because it makes the threat seem not real anymore. And it breaks the integrity and the believability of the show. We don't want to do that. But I think the right response to that was be like, okay, the audience really wants a female character that is relatable and quirky and clearly not there to be sexy and for men. You know, like, and again, they had a female friendship between Barb and Nancy, you know, had actual females, which is, and the show, there's just like rarely any women talking to each other, right? We're totally failing the Bechdel test. Thinking about that more. But their attempts to do that, to add new female characters and add diverse characters, just were completely tangential to the main plot line and just does not work.
Another thing that I was, like, again, that I felt that they really created their own problem here was with 11. Because at the end of season one, they implied really heavily that 11 was trapped in the Upside Down now.
Yeah.
And, like, now that I look back on it, I'm wondering if maybe the waffles was supposed to be an indication that she wasn't, but I just assumed that somehow she had gotten the waffles through the Upside Down, because we established that you can do that. So, like, that, like, you can open a small, like, hole and, like, pull something through, like a waffle.
I actually left season one assuming she'd be back in season two, one way or another. And I took the waffles as an indication.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. I'm not saying that she shouldn't have been back. Having the character just be gone, that would have been a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. But having her just be around in the regular world, that caused a lot of problems. And they felt like they had already set themselves up to have her be stuck in the Upside Down for season two. And as a result, like, not be able to just swoop into the rescue, and that would, so that they didn't have to have this, like, completely separate side story where she, like, tries to find her mom suddenly, and then that immediately changes into finding Callie, which immediately changes into a vengeance arc that she immediately stops, right?
It turns into a one-shot of Shadowrun, essentially.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, if she had just been in the Upside Down, she could have been, I mean, like, they frankly could have just replayed what they did with Will, but with a different flavor this time. Because instead of Will, like, delivering messages, you know, she could, like, deliver tactical psychic strikes to support her friends. But then, like, when she does that, like, exhausts her, so it's, like, super dangerous for her to do, right? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. I'm not saying they had to go.
She can do her powers from the Upside Down, but it's much harder than if she was there in person, which would justify why she just can't in and just swoop in and save the day, because it's just harder to affect, you know, the normal world from the Upside Down, you know? Basically, it would effectively power her down, which is what they needed, and why they couldn't get her involved in the plot is because she was too powerful.
Which, and her, like, running off and being sort of a shitty kid, that felt believable to me, just like, as someone who's worked with kids for a while, is like a kid who's like feeling willful and like just on the verge of becoming like almost a teenager and feeling disrespected and like the rules aren't fair and having the ability to throw tables around, like just leaving for a while, like that felt like something that could happen considering their power set. If it was an actual kid, they would have got murdered in the city or something. But since she's a psychic powerhouse, she can just leave and she'll be fine.
It felt sort of realistic, although, like, again, it was part of the, like, we have to find reasons to keep Eleven away, but the thing that disappointed me about that whole routine was simply the fact that, mm-hmm. once again, they had taken a male character and emphasized the stereotype that men are just bad at being parents. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it's about her and Hopper in their kind of, like, new father-daughter relationship. And it's clear, yeah. that Hopper, he embodies all of the negative, like, male parenting stereotypes, you know, about, mm-hmm. being overly harsh, you know, and being distant, like, being neglectful. Like, he did all of those things. And
being kept away due, mm-hmm. to work. Working, yeah. too long.
Yeah. And, I mean, if part of it is just like, okay, well, you could say he hasn't been a parent before, but he did actually have a kid. He did have a kid who passed away. So, that's not even true. And so, I found that a little bit disappointing.
Right. I mean, I can totally... Go ahead, Jim.
They also had, like, Bob being, like, a super excellent father figure and, like, really, like, supportive and trying to bring games and play with kids and, like, understanding of the space they need and, like, being, like, vocal about his affections. So I think that Harper is definitely a big negative stereotype that, you know, makes that both men force on themselves and then feel bad if they break it and stuff. And then Bob was, like, showing men the better way to be, that, oh, not bad. Though he did then give bad advice to stand up to your nightmares, and then he got eaten,
yeah,
by a smoking.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about Bob. I thought Bob was a really cool character. I was really disappointed that they killed him off, but yeah. You can't help but notice that there's a thing about Bob that he has a sort of, again, he's the former nerd from high school. He has a certain amount of dorkiness, mm-hmm. to him. He's not there. He's not supposed to seem attractive, right? Like, he's the comfortable guy that Joyce settles with, but, like, then he dies so that she can continue her romantic attention with Hopper, because Hopper is the manly man, and naturally that means he's a bad parent. Like, and, yeah.
I didn't get the feeling that Bob was, like, I seemed like Bob felt unattractive to the rest of the universe, except for, fudge, what was her name? Was, mm-hmm. it Joyce?
Joyce, yeah.
Joyce, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I felt like she super was into him and really loved him, and how, like, kind and, you know, sort of caring and accommodating. And even though there's, like, this wall of information that she doesn't share with him, he doesn't care. He tries to take care of the whole family. I felt like it was, I don't know, I didn't get the feeling that he was attractive or wrong in any way. I felt like he was... a future for people that feel like they need to be Hopper, and that they don't have to be, because when you're an adult, it doesn't matter if you're a football star. If you're, like, a cool guy, like, someone will love you, mm-hmm. just for that.
Yeah, okay, so I admittedly felt uncomfortable with the Bob-Joyce relationship for, like, and it was a very complicated set of feelings that it took me a while to figure out what was going on here. Okay, so I instinctively like Bob. Because, mm-hmm. Bob is basically me, you know, and you know,
superhero,
you know, Bob embodies my demographic of, like, nerdy kid who wasn't popular in high school and isn't super good looking and is, you know, just trying to do his best and be kind and stuff. Right. So to see that archetype, like, given a lot of candy and, like, be super important to solving the plot, that was, like, amazing. And I loved it. But at the same time, I couldn't help but feel like Bob was playing out a different, potentially toxic trope of the every nerd deserves a hot girl. Because certainly there's this thing, especially on television, although you get it in books too, but in visual mediums, mm-hmm. especially, that the guys can be unattractive, but they still get, you know, the women who are 10 out of 10, right? And you never see that, you almost never see that in reverse, right? You never see a woman who is not incredibly attractive with a super hot guy.
At least not in any stories that are meant for a general audience.
Yes, exactly. It was weird to me that like, was kind of getting in on my ability to enjoy the Bob-Joyce relationship. And at the same time, I also, like, I knew from, like, the moment they introduced Bob that he was an obstacle standing between the Joyce Hopper romance that they clearly wanted. And it felt almost like he grew out of control from what he was supposed to just be in the way to suddenly he's actually doing stuff and is, like, important to the plot. And I was like, what's happening with this guy? And then he, like, died in a way that I felt was extremely pointless. And I was annoyed by that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I felt, again, it's hard to say what they were intending with Bob, but to mm-hmm. me, he felt like that kind of temporary placeholder love interest for Joyce that was there to, like, extend her romance with somebody else, you know, so that they wouldn't feel pressured to get Joyce and Hopper together right away, you know? He was, and I don't know, and then, here's the other weird thing, Jonathan doesn't like him for, like, no reason. Like, why doesn't Jonathan like Bob? Jonathan's father, it's not like he's mad that his father's around. His father was terrible. He hates his father. So, why are you taking it on Bob? I don't know.
I think that's just normal stepkid stuff. It's pretty easy to resent someone being put in an important position in your family that you feel like you didn't have a choice in. So, like, if you're single, if your parent begins a relationship with someone and they're in your house all the time and in your biz and you don't, and you're neutral on them, constant exposure can make you resentful, especially if they're trying to, like, relate to you, and that can be annoying and grating.
I assumed that they were, like, in a room with the writers and were like, okay, guys, Jonathan's made a lot of progress in being a more likable character from last season. I think we need to undo some of that. He's too likable. I mean, make him a little less likable.
Also, Bob is, like, again, super nerdy and just sort of, like, a good-natured, like, adult, and, like, that's not cool to teenagers. Even, like, teenagers that are, like, not super jocks and, like, maybe in the future would turn into Bob, like, adults are boring and not fun and bad. And, yeah. You know.
Of course, this, I gotta say, the Jonathan not liking Bob thing just kind of pales in comparison to the whole, like, female competition thing they had going with Mike was just mean to everybody and didn't like Max for both Mike and Eleven don't like Max because of some weird internal sense that Max is there to replace Eleven, which is just like, mm-hmm. you know, they inherently know that the writers don't want to put in female characters and that they will, the female characters are competing with each other. And it's just, that was not fun. That was not a good idea.
Their writer self-inserts about their resentment for adding these female characters. They're acting out the writer's feelings.
There's just like, why are you guys making us do this?
A girl. We already had a girl. What's the problem?
Or it's like, we really want to fail the Bechdel test. How do we do that? Okay, make sure that, like, the two girls in this demographic just automatically don't get along so they never talk to each other.
Yeah, let's not, like, do anything. Let's not have her have an overprotective, bullying older sister or anything. We'll just make it the standard abusive mm-hmm. brother. Then they could at least talk about something, even if it's about how much they hate each other and are bad siblings. That's something.
All right, so we are past our time, which
too
I
bad.
Should expect
I was
for,
too,
for Stranger
I have more
things.
To say. But we don't have time.
I wanted to talk about Billy.
Well, at some point, maybe, since we have more ground to cover, maybe Jim will have you back on for part two of Stranger Things. But not part two.
Remember my full title next time.
Right. It's extra special guest host, Breaker.
Recurring, returning.
Breaker of Brains, I think.
You're bad at this. Just listen to this episode. You'll get
it. Yeah. All right. Those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythgrants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
If you like what we do, send a few dollars our way through our Patreon. Every cent goes into the hoard of gold we lounge on like dragons. Just go to patreon.com/mythgrants. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. When he came around, tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself. This has been the Mythgrant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.